Yes. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Christy Hughes on behalf of Mr. Sobrero. The state court's decision denying Mr. Sobrero's three claims wasn't just wrong, it was objectively unreasonable, and that this court should reverse the district court's denial of the writ. I'd like to start with the state court's decision on the claim that there was insufficient evidence for the special circumstance felony murder. The state court unreasonably applied the clearly established law in Tyson in determining that Mr. Sobrero wasn't a major participant. Or was a participant.
Tyson doesn't apply here as federal constitutional law, does it?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Tyson doesn't apply here as federal constitutional law because it's not a death penalty case. Is that right?
I disagree, Your Honor. So California has sort of a weird statute in that you only qualify for life without parole, which Mr. Sobrero is serving, if you qualify for the death penalty. And so that was what the California Supreme Court clarified in Banks, was that the Tyson standard applies for its major participant, the major participant standard in its felony murder statute, because you can only qualify for life without parole if you first qualify for the death penalty. And so the major participant standard in Tyson, which applies for—
But that's still a state law construction that says essentially, we don't want to do this twice, so we're going to apply the Tyson standard as a special circumstance because the decision, whether it's life or capital punishment, only comes after that. So we're going to apply Tyson, but that's a matter of state law, no?
Well, I still think Tyson applies because Tyson is what level of evidence is constitutionally required for someone who is death eligible, for someone who is a non-killer who is still death eligible. And that is still Mr. Sobrero. He is a non-killer who is serving this death eligible felony murder circumstance. If, however, this court disagrees, I think the analysis is still the same. We have a different federal law that the state court misapplied, the sufficiency standard in Jackson and the due process clause, because there was no way that a reasonable jury could have found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Sobrero was a major participant. The bank standard.
Why is that? Are you going to move to the Jackson standard now? Is that what we're going to talk about?
Yes.
Okay. Why is that the case that no reasonable jury could find?
Because that Tyson standard still applies because it's incorporated into the bank standard for major participant, for California special circumstance major participant. And so the conduct that the Tyson brothers engaged in, that actively engaged in every element of the crime, is still the standard that we are to judge major participants against. And the state courts
because the California court says so, or because the United States Supreme Court says so. I mean, this is my problem. I'm trying to figure out what law articulated by the United States Supreme Court you're relying on.
Well, I still contend that Tyson applies here because Mr. Sobrero is a non-killer who's serving this death eligible felony murder special circumstance.
Okay, but is that because you think the California court has baked Tyson in? Is that your position?
No, I still think Tyson applies just because that's the constitutional standard that's required before you're going to.
I don't know what difference it makes. It's still a sufficiency of the evidence Jackson argument, and it still incorporates the Tyson standard because that's what this California court said. It's just somewhat clarifying to get one to me that comes in through that route rather than directly, but we're still in the same place, aren't we? I.e., under the Tyson standard, was there sufficient evidence for Jackson purposes, which is a very tough standard?
Yes, Your Honor's correct. I think if you say that the Tyson standard is a federal law that applies, or if you say that it's the Jackson sufficiency standard that applies, we're still in the same place because those Tyson major participant factors are the same standards that apply to the California Penal Code 190 major participant factors.
Okay, I'm not sure I agree with you on that, but let's turn the page and get to your argument because I think I've taken you on a detour. Why is it you think no reasonable juror could decide on this evidence that he satisfies the standard, please?
So when the court went through and looked at whether he was a major participant, it overlooked several facts in the record. It overlooked the fact that he didn't participate in any of the planning, that he didn't supply any of the weapons. He didn't use a weapon himself. He didn't provide the gasoline.
Well, he was in terms of planning. He was there talking to people before they drove away. And he had something to do with the,
well, there's no evidence that
they arguably had something to do, or could be inferred to have something to do with the decision to go after this person in the first place, in some respect.
Is Your Honor talking about the point where she's already in the trunk and they're having the discussion?
That's
and
one thing. And the second thing is that she was, that he was involved in the incident where she didn't pay for the marijuana. He was directly involved in that. And supposedly the whole point of this was because the whole trigger here was that she didn't pay for that marijuana and they wanted to see that she did.
Right. So that's what happens at 10 o'clock in the morning. He goes to drop her off to sell the marijuana and she doesn't pay for him and he then leaves. Then there's all these intervening series of events that he's not involved in.
Wait a minute. Isn't the next event, though, I think he might be in a, might go to planning. I'm not trying to get in your way, but isn't he involved? When they decide to call Valencia, Valencia's going to know what to do. He's the one who reports back to the owner of the marijuana that it wasn't paid for. And he, is he not involved in all of that?
Well, he's sitting there. He's not really discussing it. It's his roommate's brother's marijuana. So he says they're kind of having this discussion. He is present for it, but he's not participating in it. He's not saying, yeah, you need to get the marijuana back. He doesn't go for it. He doesn't ask them to get, doesn't go with them. He doesn't ask them to get it back. It's this Urbano and Tornillo. Those are the two brothers. They say, do you know anyone who can help us out? They're the ones that call Reyes. He then goes with them. He says, I know this Valencia guy. It's kind of his thing. They all leave. Mr. Sobrero doesn't go with them. He doesn't ask.
Did they take his car? Did they take Sobrero's car at that point?
Not at that point, no.
When did they first decide to take Sobrero's car?
That's not till much later in the night.
When, please?
That's at nighttime. Then Urbano comes back later that night. I think it's at 8 p.m. And he says there's different reasons, or there's conflicting evidence about why they took it. So Mr. Sobrero says that Urbano asked for his car to run an errand, didn't tell him what it was going to be used for. He said yes. Esparza, who's the sort of jailhouse snitch, says Mr. Sobrero gave him the car because he wanted to demonstrate that he wasn't in on stealing any of the money or stealing the marijuana. But even Esparza,
jailhouse snitch, who might not be all that believable, but or believable at all, but we have to look at the evidence as if he
I agree. But even Esparza says that Mr.
Only on that
didn't know also, at that point.
But he's sorry, also the one who said that he took, at the scene took the girl, the victim, out of the car, which is a pretty big deal. No one else said it, but he said it, and I guess that's evidence.
It is, Your Honor, but I think what's important and what is in contrast to the Tyson brothers is at that point, there's no evidence that he knew what he was taking her out of the car for. It's not clear at that point whether they're going to leave her there, whether they're going to be beating her up, whether they're going to question her.
But wasn't Valencia already at that point holding a bottle full of gasoline? Hadn't Valencia already procured this bottle of gasoline?
He does have the gasoline, but it's not clear that he's going to spray her with it. It's not quite clear what's going to be done. It's not clear there's ever a discussion about what's going to be done.
So, counsel, then this horrific thing happens, right? And then in the aftermath, do we consider any of his conduct in the aftermath, not rendering aid? We know she survived.
We do. And I agree that's one of the factors. But we also have to compare that to the Tyson brothers. And they are just much more egregious. They're just not rendering aid. They're engaging in the shootout with police. They're leaving the cars, you know, outside the prison to help their father escape. They're bringing the ice chest of weapons in.
Yes, but they had the same argument, which they had basically the same argument. They break their dad and the other guy out of prison. They arm them. They flag down the car, innocent family. They had the same argument that they didn't know what their dad and this other convict were going to do until they did it. So I'm not sure that the distinctions you're making are helping me very much, given...
Well, even if we take the knowledge part out of it, I think they were engaged in just much more active conduct. I mean, they themselves were procuring the weapons. Mr. Sobrero didn't do
I'll grant you that. Could I, and again, I don't want to take too much of your time, but I'm not sure I understand your analysis about, I understand your argument to be that your client didn't know what was going to happen. He didn't help the plan, didn't necessarily know what they were going to do with the gasoline, even though he helped carry her, I think, to a boat. But after they set her on fire.
I don't know that he helped carry her to the boat, but.
Okay. After she was set afire, what is the answer to the question about whether we should consider his conduct after that? Because at that point, he knew clearly what was happening, and it was horrendous. So then what?
The answer is yes, we do consider it. But I think that we need to consider it in comparison to other after-the-fact conduct like the Tyson brothers. And so that's why I was trying to explain to Your Honor, after the fact in Tyson, they're engaging with an armed shootout. I mean, that's what I was trying to explain. And that's much more egregious. That's much more violent, active participation than leaving and not rendering aid. There's also the threat that's on the record from Valencia saying, do you want to stay here and be like her, or do you want to get in the car and be like us? And that threat is...
I have questions about that. At least the State Court of Appeals said that's not actually what he said was said, that was put in by the police officer. But what he actually said was, do you want to stay here? But he didn't say, do you want to be like her? That was an addition by the interrogating officer, who was the translator, but it wasn't what was said. Is that true or not true? I couldn't tell.
I do think there's a little bit of a dispute from the translation, whether or not the officer is, I mean, the translation, as I went back through the record, it's a little bit confusing as to, because the officer is translating as they're going through. It's not like a court certified translation. And so it's not clear, are they threatening him to stay here with her, be like her? That part is not clear. They're definitely threatening to leave him behind with her. It's not clear what the purpose is.
Threatening, saying, do you want to stay behind? But, and he says no. And the question was he threatened that if he stayed behind, something was going to happen to him? Again, you have a sufficiency. This is sufficiency of the evidence. If there's a view of the evidence that wasn't said, then you've got a problem.
Right? I understand that, Your Honor. My only point is, even if he did, and I agree he did, the view of the evidence is he did leave with them. He did leave for her behind. He didn't render aid. But we have to compare that to the very active and violent undertaking.
But isn't it a very big deal whether he did that because he was threatened or not threatened?
It is. I mean, he's been threatened all along the way to get in the car with them, to remain silent. He's even been threatened.
When was he threatened to get in the car with him?
Pardon, Your Honor?
When was he threatened to get in the car with him?
Well, this is the implicit threat, which sort of is part of my next argument about duress, where... Valencia is going up to him and grabbing his sleeve and yelling at him. And the argument was that the California state court had ignored all of the surrounding circumstances that contributed to finding an implicit threat. The fact that when he's grabbing his arm and walking him back to the car and yelling at him, there's also a woman bound in the trunk. There's a gun in the car. Valencia is high on meth. He's been up for days. He's this violent gang member. He's already explicitly threatened him not to talk. Valencia's also violent group of, friends is also around as sort of backup for him. And all of that is leading to an implicit threat that he needs to participate and get in the car with them, or his life is also going to be in danger. I see I only have a minute and a half left.
I have one question. We'll give you a minute or two in rebuttal. Sure. I've been wondering whether there's any interaction between the duress issue and the sufficiency on the major participant problem. Because the one thing we know he was threatened about was not to say anything. So with regard to the major participant issue, some of why he was said to be a major participant is because he didn't object, he didn't complain, he didn't, and so on. But he'd already been told if he said anything, he was in danger of being killed. So you don't quite make this argument, and it may be because the duress doesn't apply to murder, so it only applies to the underlying felony. And so it may be that the major participant issue is really the culpability for the murder, and it doesn't apply. But to me, the most interesting and intriguing thing is there seemed to be some way these two things were running at each other, because some of the evidence relied on as to why he was a major participant seemed to be things that he was threatened not to do.
Well, I tried to weave that in a little bit. Apparently, I didn't make it very clear. But, I mean, all of, I view a lot of what he was doing was just standing there passively. I mean, he was really, he was in the backseat of his own car along for the ride for much of this. And I understand, you know, he is helping get her get out of the trunk. And I understand he started this whole thing. But for a lot of it, he's present. And the state court is basing this major participant finding on him being present while other people are doing other things. He doesn't object. He doesn't stop it. Those are all passive actions. And like Your Honor says, he was told, don't even make a peep. She's going to recognize your voice. Don't say anything.
And so, right. And I think that's right. So that on this evidence, I think a fact finder could decide that he wasn't a major participant. I'm trying to figure out why. That's not the burden you're looking at with Jackson, right? It's just the opposite. So why was it why would we say this finding is unreasonable? Reasonable juror could not find.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Can you repeat that question?
Well, and maybe I'm just stating the obvious, but it just seems to me from this evidence, what your argument is that the jury could have gone the other way. A fact finder could have gone the other way on major participant, but they didn't. And the burden of proof that you got here is really tough. Why was this finding? Why would a reasonable jury couldn't decide this because what?
Because I just think the standard that was established in Tyson, I mean, that was a crime with like 10 different active violent steps in it. And those Tyson brothers are actively involved in every single step.
Is Tyson the minimum for major participant or one example of major participant?
I think it's an example. I don't think it's the minimum. But even if he's slightly around Tyson, I mean, I just don't think he comes close. He's definitely not Edmund. I concede that. But I just think he's nowhere close to Tyson. The few, you know, he let his car be loaned. He drove her 12 hours before he ever gets back involved. And he helps take her out of the trunk, which Valencia orders him to do. And there's no evidence he even knew that he was getting her, what he was getting her out of the trunk for. That's just so far afield from the Tysons engaging in this detailed planning and preparation, being willing to kill themselves if it came to that. I mean, they knew what they were getting into. They break into the prison themselves. They just are actively involved at every single detailed point of that crime. And Mr. Sobrero is just nowhere close to that. And folding in the duress on top of it, I just think makes it even a stronger case that a reasonable jury just could not find that he met that standard. I see I'm way over my time. I apologize.
I'll give you a minute or two in rebuttal, depending on what.
Thank you, Your Honor.
He has to say, or how long he has to say it in. Mr. O'Connor, you just went dark for some reason.
Yes, I'm having a hard time unmuting my video here. Can you hear me at least?
Yes,
we can hear you.
Yeah,
we can
see you. I don't know what the problem is with my video, frankly.
We just had your video a second ago. I did. There you are. I can see you.
There you are.
You see me?
Yeah, don't touch anything. We can see
you. Okay. You can see me and you can hear me.
We can see you and we can hear you.
Okay, very good. So initially, I would just like to say that the question of what comprises the elements of California special circumstance is a matter of state law and should not be relitigated. But I did want to go into the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence. And First, I'd like to point out that by his own admission, defendant suspected that the discussion between Reyes and Ortega regarding the victim, could mean that they were going to kill her. The defendant.
Can I ask you about that? That evidence, I think, is important. Can you tell me where is it in the timeline? At what point?
Sure. So this would have been after he, transported the victim and the marijuana. And after he dropped off the victim at the house to sell the marijuana, and after the victim, came back and he asked her, where's the money?
Right, but that's still morning, right? Isn't all that? It's hours earlier, isn't it?
Right, correct. So the defendant learns from the victim she does not have the money or the marijuana. So the defendant then reports to Reyes and or Ortega that the victim did not, produce the money.
Right. Do we know what time that happened?
It's early in the process. It's, You know, it's hard to say whether it's the morning or.
I think you have the same problem with the timeline I do. I understand the sequence. I was trying to nail down how many hours earlier, but thank you.
It's very early in the process. Like I say, he informs Reyes and Ortega about the missing money. That starts the whole ordeal. He overhears this conversation between Reyes and Ortega, and he hears them say, well, we can't leave things the way they are. Reyes said he knew somebody who could do them a favor. Defendant said he did not know what they meant, but he thought it could mean that they could kill the victim. Okay, and we can infer that this was before the victim was kidnapped. This was before the defendant lent his car to his confederates.
Now,
that
statement comes from his statement to the police?
That's his statement to the police, correct.
Go ahead.
Yes.
He said a lot of things to the police.
Yes, correct. Additionally, there's some additional evidence that this conversation occurred before he lent his car to the Confederates. Defendant admitted he was present when Ortega found out the victim had not paid for the drugs. Ortega became angry and said the victim had done him wrong, and he called Reyes for a favor. Reyes said he knew somebody who could do the favor, and so Reyes and Ortega then left to meet Valencia. So again, that was early in the process before defendant lent his car to his Confederates. So that's all evidence of reckless indifference. It's all evidence that the defendant was aware of the possibility that the victim could be killed before he lent his car to his Confederates. So it's evidence of reckless indifference. It's also evidence of major participation.
But that wouldn't be enough. I mean, wouldn't that category, if everything had stopped there, then we'd certainly be on the other side of the Tyson line.
Right. There's a lot more evidence of reckless indifference, a lot more evidence of major participation. I'll give you another item of evidence. Defendant admitted to Esparza that he loaned his car to the others to prove he was not involved in the disappearance of the drugs. The jury was entitled to infer that defendant loaned his car to the others knowing the victim would be kidnapped. The defendant met the other men at a gas station. The men were trying to hold him responsible for the disappearance of the drugs. The men asked him to loan them his car, and they were going to get the drugs back from the victim. The defendant was told he had to drop off his car so the others would kidnap the victim. Defendant claimed he did not know what was going to happen, but he did let the others borrow his car. And again, you know, he overheard this conversation between Reyes and Ortega earlier, where...
But if all that had happened and he hadn't been physically present,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think you're going to have to speak up.
I said that it was just the way you said it that I thought was funny. Okay. But sadly, you were talking to a child.
If
all that had happened and he hadn't been in the car and physically present during the murder, I still think you'd be on the other side of the Tyson line. You're just building up. So it's
right,
you're
correct.
Not arguing all of this. That up to that point, he would have been a major participant. Up to that point, all you have is he lent somebody his car for something he thought was probably going to be or could have been a murder.
Well, yeah, I think at the very least, I think at this point we would have reckless indifference. You know, we might have major participation. I mean, this was a kidnapping. You know, the defendant had reason to believe that this was a kidnapping and it could result in a murder. And here he's providing the instrumentality of the kidnapping, the car. So that is a major element of participation there. But there is more. Both in terms of major participation and reckless indifference. He was present at the planning stage at the Sycamore House when defendant's having a conversation with Ortega and Valencia. That's when Valencia is holding the bottle of gasoline, you know, where it's obvious that Valencia intends to, pour the gasoline on the victim and kill her, at least seriously burn her.
Or threaten to do that.
I'm not sure why it's obvious that he would have done what he did. It's certainly a threat, an implied threat, but I don't know obvious counsel on that point.
Right. It's at least reasonable to think that Valencia will pour the gasoline on the victim and burn her or something like that.
It's at that point that I begin to wonder what the relevance of the threats were, because it somewhere right around then, I don't know if it was just before or just after he got the gasoline in the bottle, Valencia told the defendant, the petitioner, not to say anything, or he be treated like her. So at that point, what's he supposed to do if he can't say anything?
Well,
he can't say we shouldn't be doing this, and he can't say I don't want any part of us, and he can't say I don't want to get in the car. I mean, anything he says can get him killed.
Right. Well, let me just say a few words about the state law defense of duress, and it requires a present and active threat of imminent danger, and it requires a demand to participate in the crime. So that
what was the second? I didn't hear that.
There has to be a demand that the defendant participate in the crime.
Okay.
So
but you see, this crime, at least the major participant part of it, is being defined in part by whether he spoke up. So it seems to be some element of this part of the special circumstance that he has to speak up.
Well,
that's what he's being told he can't do, or all that killed.
Well, just to be clear on this point, Valencia's threats, as related by defendant, we have to keep that in mind, that this defendant relating these alleged threats. But anyway, the threats concerned the consequences for their speaking when the victim could hear his voice and potentially identify him, or telling others about the crime. So those were
But still events to you can't talk.
Well,
so how could he say, I don't want to do this, or you shouldn't be doing this, or I don't want any part of this, or anything?
Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. For example, I think that when defendant was talking to Valencia and Ortega at the Sycamore house, when Valencia had the bottle of gasoline and the three men were talking, I mean, at that point, defendant could have said, I think this is a bad idea. I do not think we should pour gasoline on the victim, that type of thing.
Was they weren't next to the car at that point?
I'm sorry?
They weren't near the car, or the threat hadn't happened yet?
That was at the Sycamore house. I think I think they were away from, they were in a field away from the victim, away from the car.
I mean,
so how many minutes out? I think my understanding of the duress instruction, had one been requested, is that he would have to show his life was immediately threatened. And I don't, again, on the timeline, it's hard to get a sense of.
Right. Well, present and active threat of imminent danger. So it does have to be an imminent threat under state law.
Counsel, that's the part I know. What I'm asking about is factually, can you help me out with how what is the duration? What distance is there, either temporally or geographically, between that statement and her being lit on fire?
Let's see. I mean, I'm not sure I can give you an exact time frame, but I think the comments about, the defendant should be quiet so the victim does not recognize his voice. I think those comments occurred before the planning session at the Sycamore house. And so
she was in the trunk. She was in the trunk.
Yes.
She was in the trunk.
Correct. Yes. And then,
so if they occurred well after she was in the trunk, how much distance could there have been temporally?
I'm not entirely sure if I can give you an exact time frame, but I know there was, she was in the trunk of the car, and I think, that's when Valencia made these statements about don't speak when the victim can hear you, because she might recognize your voice, essentially. And then there was the planning session at the Sycamore house, and then Valencia and Ortega and defendant got into the car and drove to the murder scene. And
Hold on a second. We lost Judge Kristen. I don't see her. Does anybody see her square? Looks like we may have lost her.
Oh, this happened yesterday, unfortunately.
Hi, Judge. I'm looking into it. But it looks like she is disconnected for now.
Wait.
I'll try to get her back on as soon as I can.
I would rather not go forward. Apparently she did miss a chunk of the argument yesterday, Judge Beatty, and until we realized she wasn't there. So I would rather not do it. These are the major downsides of what's otherwise not a bad system, but it basically happens at least once in an argument day that something goes wrong. It was the day that my entire internet system went out for the entire day, Comcast, and I ended up being frantic the whole day and finally had to do it on the telephone. And even that was hard to do because I couldn't get much of a signal. Because everybody else in Berkeley's Comcast was out also. So it was very difficult to get cellular service.
There she is. I see her.
Oh, are you back?
I'm back. Yes.
All right, Mr. O'Connor, I'm not sure who is engaging with you. I think it was just Christian.
Where I left off, I had asked you about the temporal relationship between that she was in the trunk and there's a statement it made about being quiet. And I'm trying to figure out how much later it was. And you explained there was a meeting at the Sycamore House. Let me ask you, once they drove her, when she was in the trunk and drove her, how far did they take her?
Frankly, Your Honor, I don't recall. I don't recall how far of a distance that was.
All right, counsel, I'll dig it out. I'll dig it out of the record. I have looked for this.
A quite short distance.
Yeah, I think it was essentially in the same city, the city of Delhi.
I've got. Thank you, counsel. I don't want to take up any more time.
Okay, let's see. You have a little more time, so if there's anything else you'd like to address. I mean, you haven't gotten to the fact that he took her out of the car, which...
Well, right. Well, yeah, sure. Sure, that's another excellent fact. Let's see. So he participated in the planning session at the Sycamore House, and then, they drove to the murder scene, and...
Presumably, that's not subject to my concern in the sense that he didn't have to say anything to do that.
I apologize, Your Honor. I
said that is not subject to my concern because he didn't have to say anything to do that.
Okay, yes, okay. So at the murder scene, he assisted with the removal of the victim from the trunk of the car. You know, he stood by as his cohorts set the victim on fire.
Stand by goes back to the same problem.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I mean, what's he going to say? I mean, I guess he could have run away. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he did have an opportunity to express an objection, for example, at the planning session at the Sycamore House.
No, all right, now we're back to the same problem. But frankly, from your point of view, the best answer to my concerns is that there was no such argument, i.e. no one's been arguing that it's the major participant part that the duress applies to as opposed to the underlying kidnapping by itself. But in any event, I mean, I'm fairly concerned about it because at many turns when you talk in the major participant analysis, you run into he didn't say anything. That's what bothers me.
Yeah. Well, one other thing I would like to mention about major participant, I think I may have mentioned this before, but I think it's worth reiterating, is defendant's statement to Esparza that, he loaned the car to the others to prove he was not responsible for the missing drugs. And based on that, the jury was entitled to infer that the defendant loaned his car to the others knowing the victim would be kidnapped. And that comes from, Esparza's testimony and or pretrial statement that was admitted at trial. And I think that's very important in terms of major participation. And, I don't think that has anything to do with any threats. I don't think that he was threatened at that point, at the time he loaned his car.
Well, Vasquez said in his post-trial testimony that he was sort of implicitly threatened because Vasquez did have a gun and did essentially point to the gun when the threats were being made.
Yeah, as I recall, Vasquez's declaration said he just had the gun. He just displayed the gun. I do not think he ever pointed it at the defendant.
But I guess you're back to the same problem, which is still the verbal threat had to do with him speaking up and not with him participating in the crime.
Yeah, right. That's true. Yeah, so Valencia's threats were either threats that defendant should remain quiet in the presence of the victim so the victim did not recognize his voice, or
did he say so the victim wouldn't recognize your voice?
No, but it was don't speak so the victim cannot hear him. So that was the threat, and then also a threat not to tell other people about the crime. But that's not the same thing as a threat to actually participate in the crime. And then I did want to say a few words about my supplemental authority, Shin. So the opposing briefs argue and invite the court to hold de novo rather than framing the relevant question as whether a fair-minded jurist could reach a different conclusion. And that's Shin versus KR 141 Supreme Court at 524. And then also the second point is the state court decision has to be more than clear error. In fact, it has to be far more than even clear air, and that's Shin at 523. And so with that, unless there are any further questions, I think I'm prepared to submit the matter.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Hughes. Give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one quick point on the duress and the threats and the major participant. The Vasquez's declaration is that he put his gun or his hand on the gun that was in his holster, and that it was a threat to participate, that if Mr. Sobrero didn't participate, that he would be killed, that it was an implicit threat when he did that. But the threats, I think the threat from Valencia when he grabs him and walks him to the car, that's a threat to participate. And so I think in addition to the explicit threat.
Exactly is the testimony on that. My impression was that he sort of pulled him with his shirt sleeve, but wasn't violent or anything.
Well, I don't know that it has to be violent to be a threat. He says that he's yelling at him. He has this raised voice. He's irritated. And then this is at 2 ER 358. He says he grabbed him by the sleeve and then he walks him over to the car. He grabbed him and led him to the vehicle, not all the way. So he sort of grabs him and pulls him to the car, because this is after Mr. Sobrero sees the bottle of gasoline and he doesn't get in the car with everybody else. Everybody else just willingly walks over and Mr. Sobrero isn't joining them. And so that's when Valencia goes over. But I think, as I argued in the briefs, when you combine it with all the other circumstances, I don't think Valencia has to say much for this to be an implicit threat, given everything else that's happening. But as Your Honor pointed out, a lot of what the state points to is just not saying anything as major participation. But some of the other things that it points to, like getting her out of the car, or loading his car out, those are also things that the other people like Valencia are telling him to do. And so when you combine the duress evidence, which I'm not sure that it necessarily has to rise to a level of duress to get an instruction to be considered a threat that would lead him to do something if we're folding it into the major participant analysis. I mean, if he's doing these things under a threat, I think that's still something relevant to consider when you're considering if he's a major participant under the Tyson standard or under the Bank standard.
Okay, so the time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thank you for your arguments. Sobrero versus Doe is submitted, and we'll go to the last case of the day and of the week, Ingersoll versus Coca-Cola.